The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins is brought to you by three great sponsors. They include Hunt a Killer, Simply Safe, and Upside. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
D. Watkins here with Undisclosed, the Killing of Freddie Gray. Today I will be joined by my co-host, Amelia McDonald Perry. Amelia is a writer, reporter, and editor with over 15 years of experience in media. She writes regularly about crime and pop culture for The Rolling Stone. We also have Apostle Kenji Scott, Baptist preacher for over 30 years and longtime activist. And one of my favorite people in the universe, the great Jane Miller. Jane is the chief investigative reporter with the 11 Investigates I team at WBAL. She has a reputation for breaking stories that otherwise may never be told. Her work has uncovered corrupt public officials and unethical practices in private business. She has raised issues of accountability and effectiveness in public policy. Welcome. Thank you guys for being here today. I want to start with Kenji and a lot of our listeners, they don't really know the reality that a person like Dante Allen has to live through. They don't really understand that world. They come from a world where, you know, police officers like change their tires and, you know, look out for their families and show love. Could you just give them like a brief idea of what a person like Dante has to face?
I grew up in East St. Louis, Illinois, right across the river from St. Louis, Missouri, probably a good 20 minutes from Ferguson. I played in Ferguson, grew up around Ferguson and all of that. And growing up black in a community, in a polarized community like St. Louis, we faced racism every day. And by the mere fact of a colorized skin, we were already identified as guilty of some crime. Even before the police knew what crime it was, we were already labeled. The situation with Dante was really disheartening. It was familiar, but disheartening altogether the same. Because there was really no reason to even stop the brother, you know, and they stopped him and he had a few bags of marijuana, which is common. You know, you may even catch me, you know, a few years ago, more recent. But to be honest, I mean, we see it every day. And we don't just see it from white police officers. We see it also from black police officers. You know, racism is a culture, I think, within all police departments across this nation. So I wasn't surprised, but disheartened, yes, you know, which was the same thing with chasing Freddie Gray. I mean, the mere fact that we're black labels us criminals. I mean, I remember when I came home from college and I was a freshman in 1990 and I was in Jennings, which is right next door to Ferguson, and I was visiting my cousins and we were just out talking to friends and the police pulled up and they wanted to search us and question us. And I was being sarcastic when they asked me for my ID. And so instead of giving them a state-issued ID, I pulled out my Southern Illinois University student ID that identified me as a student of Southern Illinois University Carbondale. And the police called me a smartass. And the next thing he asked me, did I want him to hit me in the head with a flashlight? Those things for us are common. I grew up in East St. Louis, and when we would travel to a little town called Belleville, Illinois, which is right up State Street from where I live, there would be a police officer sitting at the border of both cities. It was a white police officer. And as we would go into Belleville, the police would be there to check us as we go into another municipality. So for me, growing up as a black man at 47, getting close to 50, I've experienced it all of my life.
It's a regular thing. It's like I don't expect a major change within the police department during my lifetime. Like, I don't even, that's not one of my life goals. Like, I got better chance of, like, going on a date with Beyonce than seeing, like, police reform.
To add to that, that what Kenji is saying, I've been covering Baltimore for almost 40 years, and I try to tell folks that live in the suburbs, look, you don't understand the reality of a West Baltimore. You know, probably where you live in a suburban area or a more stable neighborhood, et cetera, you probably don't see police a lot. But in a West Baltimore, you see them a lot. because they are very present. And so I always say, you know, if you're white and living in the suburbs and you want to sit out on your porch and have a beer, probably nobody's going to bother you. But you do that in Penn North and West Baltimore, and yeah, someone's going to show up and you're going to have an interaction. And when you have a tense relationship that has years and years and years of tentacles to it, there are often are not many positive interactions that go on between police departments and minority communities. I mean, just it's a reality.
It doesn't exist. Like, and you know, you can speak to this, Amelia, because I'm sure you talk to a lot of different people, but they're in the community, but they're not in the community in any positive way for the most part. Every once in a while, you get a police officer that wants to like play catch or something like that, but you know, jump shots and playing catch or waving high every once in a while doesn't erase the real problems that exist.
Well, that's, and it's been policy for so long too in a city like Baltimore with zero tolerance and all of that, that this is just the way it is.
When you look at also just like what those, you know, three bike officers were up to that morning is, you know, you have in the span of, God, 25 minutes, they have detained and arrested, although neither was put through central booking, but two men for doing essentially nothing. You know, you have Freddie Rann, and then supposedly they find this knife. Dante comes out of a store having no purchases in his hand. That was his big mistake. And that gave them reason to stop him. And then supposedly he said something about buying a Lucy. And then that was a whole other reason for the police to then escalate. And you're thinking, to me, I'm looking at that and I'm like, this is what you're doing for the last 25 minutes? Like, this is what you're doing for your job? It's incredible.
Which is one of the reasons, and Jane can attest to this, is why I have for the last few years been pushing community engagement, non-punitive community engagement between the police department and the Black community. I pushed it and pushed it. It hasn't happened yet because that's what we need. We need those relationships in order to drive down violence in our community. We can't do it without the police, and the police can't do it without us. And so one of the things that I've been pushing is that we have a non-punitive engagement plan. So that relationship with Dante and that relationship with Freddie are no longer commonplace in our community. Because until we get to a point where we can engage the police department in a way that's friendly, it's not going to work. We can't continuously engage the police. Every time we see them, the fear is and the trepidation is that we're going to be arrested. We're going to be beat, we're going to be handcuffed, and we're going to be accused of things that are so silly as buying a Lucy.
Who's responsible for making the first step? Because I feel like I don't have to be extra nice to a police officer initially because I pay a lot of taxes. Like, I pay them. Like, they work, you know. Like, I don't feel like I got to step up and be like, you know what, let's build a relationship.
Yeah, it is totally the police responsibility. They are the ones, that's what I'm calling to do it. I'm not calling us to do it.
Right.
You know, historically, Black folks are the most forgiving folks on earth.
Tell me about it, man. Why am I cursed with that? Like, I've forgiven people for stuff before they even do anything.
Yeah, so it is the responsibility of this police department specifically. I went through it with two. I'm going through it with the one right now. And so that's one of the things, that is the primary, that's why I wasn't 100% for this consent decree, because when you look at the community engagement aspect of it, the conflict in the Black community exists between the police department and Black men. That was not included in that consent decree. You know, you talk about historical institutions like churches and community organizations, though most of us don't even attend church. Church membership is down across the board in the Black community. And as a former executive director of a community association here in Baltimore, look, we had less than 5%, if that, attending community meetings. And so to think that the responsibility should be borne on the shoulders of the Black church and community association, it's just not going to happen. That responsibility has to be initiated by the city and by the police department. Only where it's going to happen.
So just to like, you know, just to paint like a bigger picture of what that disconnect looks like, Jane said something that was really, really interesting. The idea of Dante saying that he didn't speak to the police, he spoke to homicide.
When we interviewed him.
When you interviewed him.
Right. Clearly, Mr. Allen must have been feeling some heat because he was really trying to get his story out, knowing that his statement had already been recorded by the police on April 12th, the day that Freddie was arrested and injured. And yeah, what struck me is in the, and you hear it in the segment too, is his saying, look, I wasn't talking to police. I was talking to homicide. Is making this difference between a police officer on the street and the patrol officer and the detective that shows up, you know, trying to solve something. I thought too, it's an intriguing part of that interview.
And I felt so bad from him from the beginning because it was so clear that he had found himself suddenly wrapped up in something so much bigger than
huge.
he had any idea of. You know,
by the time he does the media interviews on the 30th of April, the riot has already happened on the 27th. There's been unrest on the 25th. Everybody's, you know, there's a lot of pressure everywhere, and yeah, and he finds himself right in the middle of it. And he had been for at least a week trying to move that story that he wanted to tell.
He didn't want to go to jail, but then at the same time, he didn't want to be a snitch. He didn't want to be a snitch. He had to come back home.
Yeah, he lives.
And then the other,
he lives in his place of residence at the time was a block away from Penn North. So,
like literally, like you could throw a stone hard at his window.
That's yeah. Right. And people in the neighborhood knew that he was the second guy in the wagon. So, yeah, there was a lot of pressure on him.
So they were going to put pressure on him. And the police officers needed their story to line up. So what perfect thing to do other than put that pressure on him?
Hi, listeners of Undisclosed. I'm very excited to tell you about this next sponsor because ever since I was a kid, I have been obsessed with mysteries. All of Agatha Christie, all of Nancy Drew, all of Hardy Boys, I read it all. I used to look for mysteries to solve. I remember being in middle school and finding this trailer in the backyard of a friend's house with a dead bird pressed up against the glass. And I created an entire mystery in my head about how it got there. So if you're anything like me, take a listen. You're gonna love this sponsor. I'm talking about a new subscription service called Hunt a Killer. Now, maybe you've heard about it because people are obsessed. Hunt a Killer sends a package to your home every month full of really weird, creepy correspondence from their killer curator. I've gotten these packages. They're full of all kinds of fascinating little clues. This curator is a little bit like Hannibal Lecter, and he's got a mystery for you to solve. And every month, you get a new clue or clues. You get letters, articles, objects, tools, pictures, all adding to an ongoing murder mystery. And it's up to you to solve it. Now, you can join by logging on to huntakiller.com and applying for membership. But here's the thing, they are growing so fast that they have to limit new members to 500 a week. But if you are an armchair detective or you know somebody who is, this is the perfect thing to put your sleuthing skills to the test. Once you apply and you're approved for membership, you're going to receive a private link to subscribe. Then every month, a package arrives at your door. Waiting for it is the hardest part. Hunt a Killer has been featured in BuzzFeed, Fast Company, and Bustle. It's forming a cult-like community of web sleuths and amateur detectives. If you love to pore over creepy codes, ciphers, and clues, Hunt a Killer is simply perfect. And if it's not for you, I have a feeling you know at least one person that would love to receive it as a gift. Right now, my teenager is obsessed with it too. I cannot recommend this membership enough. To help support our show, Hunt a Killer has offered a 10% discount for our listeners, which is tracked to this message. Use the code SOLVE and get 10% off. That's SOLVE. Log on to huntakiller.com and apply for membership and help hunt a killer.
There was a narrative that, Amelia, I know you're very familiar with, having worked on this case extensively.
Yeah.
There was a narrative that was really promoted by many quarters that, one, Freddie injured himself. Two, he had a history of injuring himself. Three, mm-hmm. he had prior back or spinal problems. That was a very strong narrative. And it got stronger the longer it went as the investigation unfolded.
Right, right.
So the statement that Dante Allen makes to that detective on April 12th, to those detectives on April 12th, fits the narrative perfectly, right? I mean, right. That's the... When I read the statement, here's the things that struck me. A, he couldn't see the other side of the van. So he couldn't see what was going on.
Yeah.
B, if he does hear any pounding, how do you know it's someone's head? And then C, it really struck me as just interesting when he was asked about, and you were taken to the district, right? And he says... Yeah, Northwest. It was the Northwest District.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it makes no sense.
Dante Allen knows where the Western District is.
Right.
Living in it and having prior contact, he knows exactly where the Western District is. I don't know what that was about. That didn't sound like a slip of the tongue to me. I just don't know what it was about.
I mean, I definitely have found my mind wandering down all sorts of roads wondering about that.
The deal that Dante, whatever he was offered to make that statement or to corroborate that story, or if it actually happened like that...
You know, their claim would be that they didn't, that there was no sort of deal as far as his statement was given. You know, their point of view is that they, you know, they detained him, they were arresting him, and they were bringing him down to the Western District to essentially sort of debrief him, but to sort of take it, they call it to making him into a CI, which is sort of like, it's a much bigger process than just taking somebody down to the district to debrief and asking them some questions about crime in the neighborhood. But that was their sort of excuse. And then, you know, once they got down there, suddenly, you know, Dante has this story about Freddie banging his head in the van. But what our questions have been is, well, was that really ever his story, or was this something that was sort of a seed that was planted in his head by potentially one of the officers? Because he was sort of went through this whole debrief with Officer Novak that was not recorded. And then he was taken down to headquarters to give this statement and was not asked any questions about his arrest. I mean, that makes sense because he needs to be, as far as his arrest is concerned, the officers who were involved in that would be the ones to sort of handle that part of the interview. But it was like, I don't know. I look at it and I wonder if he was picked up from the very beginning for reasons that had nothing to do with him buying a Lucy or, you know, potentially having a weapon.
But so that's the black loophole. You could be picked up for anything.
Well, right, exactly.
You can just grab anybody. The funniest thing, if we can revisit this, and I would like everyone to speak on this, how stupid does that story sound? He's banging his own head. He's just banging his head. He's banging his head so hard. Like, how dumb. Like, talk about
so
thinking
cruel.
On your toes.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, that was something that the cops were saying before Dante ever said it. That's one of the things we talk about in the episode is how Angelique Herbert, who was the paramedic on scene, she testified that, you know, when she was asking the officers, like, what happened to Freddie? Like, what happened here? The white officer at the scene said to her, oh, we think he was banging his head.
What's the IQ requirement to be able to get a badge? Because that's just a stupid story. It doesn't make any sense. First, because at one point you're saying he's calm. Like, when you arrested him, he was calm. He didn't cause any trouble, right? Now he's in the back of the paddy wagon and he's banging his head so hard that he hurts himself. Like,
and it was
on.
Like that all morning. Like they were constantly flip-flopping between him either being non-compliant and like a dead fish or, you know, making the van shake back and forth and back and forth and being crazy.
125-pound man making a 6,000-pound van shake. Guess he's an X-Man now.
When I was reporting on this, on his death, I mean, we used the video of the stop when Dante Allen was loaded at Stop 5, as it's known. And you can see that both doors of the right side of the van are open, which I pointed out in my reporting. And that, what does that tell you? That tells you don't have a combative prisoner.
Not at all.
Because if you had
like
a combative prisoner,
casually.
You wouldn't have both doors open, right?
Yeah.
You would have, no, you would have it closed up so that your prisoner wouldn't jump out and run or something else. So clearly, the other thing that in the course of our reporting.
How did the prosecutors miss that?
Well, I don't know that anybody missed anything. I mean, that video is pretty clear, isn't it? Isn't that video clear?
I think
the story,
it's pretty clear.
So it's clear, sure.
I think the thing with the Stop 5 video is like, how far are you going to go with that video? Like, what's your accusation going to be using that video? And for me, like in my mind, do I think that there was some sort of like a conspiracy element happening? Personally, yes. Is that something that is... that you can prove easily in court? I don't know about that. I think that's part of the reason why, as suspicious as that Stop 5
footage
looks.
Even dealing with the inconsistency in the officer's stories?
I mean, listen, I agree with you. I would have gone balls to the wall on that.
And then they all get together and a little powwow and say that he beat his own head. Like, he beat, come on, like, come on.
There's so much that just doesn't work.
Even if he beat his own head, there was absolutely no way that he would sever his neck from his spine, even beating his head.
Nope. It's like not possible to do. Like,
well, there's no evidence
still
of it either. That's
yeah, right. There's that that's too.
That's pretty critical, is that there's no evidence of that kind of injury.
Not at all. I mean, that's the thing. He had one, we'll get into this when we do our autopsy episode, but, you know, if he had been repeatedly banging his own head, there would have been trauma to his head to suggest that. There was one major hit to the head.
And I was at both the visitation and the funeral. And at the visitation, you was able to see even more than you were at the funeral, because you was able to look at the body longer. And there was no visible signs of any of that at all.
Yeah.
You know, because he had an open casket. So everybody would have seen that.
Right. Oh, it's so sad.
Well, one thing I'll add, as because we talked a little bit about the consent decree and what's happened in 2 years. You know, there's a really simple solution to the mystery of Freddie Gray, to the extent there's any mystery, and that is a camera in the wagon, which now exists mm-hmm. in the Baltimore Police Department. I don't know how... I can't speak for departments around the country, but the one of the things that has changed, and certainly on April 12th of 2015, if there was a camera rolling in the back of that wagon, we would know exactly what happened. And right. we would see it happen. We would see why it happened, probably, and how everybody dealt with it. And that obviously is the value of the move towards recording interactions that go on between police and the public. So that's just noting that's one of the big changes that's happened.
Right. And for just the things that happened to him throughout the whole day, you know, like, you know, my argument has been whatever was the trauma, the fatal injury, that's one thing. It's its own separate thing. If it happened during the arrest or at the second stop and it happened to be that's where the fatal injury occurred, that's one thing. But to me, even if what happened at stops one and two, the things that witnesses say they saw happen, those things still matter. Those things still deserve to be talked about, whether or not they caused the fatal injury or not.
Well, I think the majority of us here in Baltimore and across the nation saw him getting into in the back of that paddy wagon already injured. He was obviously in pain. And that was not discussed. I mean, from my perspective, I went to the trial. And that wasn't really discussed. What happened when he was arrested in the Gilmore Homes was not discussed in detail. The man was injured going into the paddy wagon.
And that mainly explains the public's rage, right? We're watching this video yes. over and over again, and we're just going to get like none yes. of that stuff. None of that stuff matters. None of that stuff is valid.
Well, right, because the assumption is because the medical examiner's autopsy ruled out stops one and two as where the fatal injury occurred, it's like everything that happened during stops one and two sort of ceased to matter. And, you know, whether or not it would have helped or hurt the state during trial is a sort of strategic issue that can be, I'm sure, debated back and forth for eternity. But for us telling this story and talking about what happened to Freddie, to me, everything that happened at stops one and two, whether it caused the fatal injury or not, are just as relevant to discussing what happened to him.
He was injured. He was still alive at the point I started reporting on it. I mean, I pointed out that as I looked at the video that was shot by one of the bystanders, as he got into the van under his own weight, could turn around, and he said something. And I was basing that on the fact that I had covered prior fatal injuries in police wagons in which individuals died. And they similar injury, et cetera. There's one in 2005 that was a very similar injury. So from the moment that I started reporting based on what was before me with the video and the extent of the injury and the type of injury that it was, which we were aware of very quickly because of the family and friends that were sharing that information, it really appeared to be this is something that in terms of the severity of the spinal injury, it happened inside the wagon because of his condition as he got into the van. But I think you're raising a really interesting, whether or not it gets into a court, but the treatment of him prior to getting into the wagon, I mean, that's really the larger discussion about the whole relationship that goes on in these communities. I mean, Freddie ran, okay? He ran. And he is taken into custody, before he gets in the wagon, he's in custody, and because he ran. So what appears on that video, what you're seeing on that video is the result of him running down the street from the police, right?
And making eye contact.
And making eye contact, right?
If that even happened, who even knows? Sometimes
that's what
I
wonder. Well, you can see him running. I mean, he's
so,
running.
So like, what is like, it's like, so what is Justin for a person like Dante looks like? I mean, because we can argue that he was also picked up just to corroborate their story as like a joke. You know, 6 bags of weed. Isn't that like legal? I mean, like,
I don't know. You know, the new law went into
and
effect
a couple
in October.
Suboxone
I was thinking
strips.
That. I wonder how much it was because, you know, 10 grams and under is like, you
he's
know,
telling you that he's
citations.
Fighting, he's telling you that he's fighting addiction. Like, he's telling you.
Well, what's yeah, going that's on the thing.
He's not being, you know, so again, these police officers are rogue. They go out into these streets. They do whatever they want to do. And then as soon as you question them, there's like, you know, there's so many jerks on Twitter who are like sending me all of these. You know, and my mentions are so full of different social medias of people like giving their whole, this whole idea of, you know, the police officer is more important than the person at McDonald's. And I'm like, not by my perspective. It doesn't tie into my social context. The burger guy at McDonald's is going to feed us. The police officer
yes.
harasses us. Which one is more important? I don't, you know, it's that simple.
And also like what, it's a bizarre concept to me to be thinking about people in terms of whose life is more valuable and who deserves to be treated
oh, oh,
with
no,
respect
no, no,
and
no,
dignity,
no,
you know?
No, officers,
like,
police,
screw that.
Many police officers think that their job is more important, you know,
oh, yeah.
than teacher, you know, than reporter, than especially podcast hosts. Oh, I'm a cop way more important than people that host a podcast. I'm risking, you're not risking your life because you're not, so there's volunteer firefighters. I've never met a volunteer cop. You know what I'm saying? Like you're not risking your life, you know, because you're a hero. It's a job. It's benefits. It's to feed your family. It's to get like a discount on Nike boots. Like this is why you do it.
Well, you know, I think that it's worth noting too in the context of what we're talking about in this particular moment, as it pertains to the case involving the death of Freddie Gray, which is that interaction that went on initially. Which is why they have that. Which why they're in each other's company to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at what is—it's now 2017, and the tone in Washington as it pertains to law enforcement is changing dramatically. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've covered all last week the ultimate signing of the consent decree in Baltimore, but this came after the Department of Justice twice asked for the whole process to be delayed because of quote unquote grave concerns about these types of reform instruments. So to the extent that you're going to see reforms, you know, to the kind of relationships and policing and practices, I don't know what the future of that is in going forward, at least as long as this administration is in Washington.
Oh, my God. Jeff Sessions, what a joke. Like, are you serious?
He ordered all of them to be reviewed on March 31st. That's correct. Yeah, know? All of the consent decrees
so
to be reviewed.
So where's right. the faith? And one of my old students had messaged me saying, you know, and who's like in a cop or in the process of becoming a cop. I don't know, but he says something to the effect of, well, remember, you know, when you get in trouble, remember, you're going to have to call a cop. And I'm like, yo, no, I don't. Like, no, I'm not. Like, we don't call
like
police officers. Like, what are you talking about? Where do these people come from? Like, it's crazy.
It's
you should talk about
the go-to excuse every single time.
Right. No,
and it's
you should...
like every single time anybody sort of, when you try and talk about issues with police officers, misconduct, brutality, anything like that. The immediate response is either, well, not all cops. And then who are you going to call when you need help?
I get
and
that
it's
all
like,
the time
well,
in social media.
Some people may not call the police
well,
because they,
them.
Yeah.
It's just saying, who are you going to call when you need a report for an insurance claim?
Right.
Okay, you got me on that one.
That thinking only relates to interactions with minorities.
Right.
You know, there's a level of, it's a level of dehumanization. That when you interact with minorities, you can treat them any kind of way. But then again, for so long, even here in Baltimore City, we have been somewhat non-responsive to every other person who died in police custody, with the exception of Freddie Gray. We had Anthony Anderson, Tyrone West, we had George King, we had several others
way back.
Prior to Freddie Gray.
But that's, Nick Kinji, that's true. That's true. Nationally, I mean, that's it's a very rare thing to have a police officer charged in an on-duty death. And I mean, look at the result around the country. I mean, this
or
is,
even to get the attention that Freddie's death
that's
did.
Correct.
Yeah, you can't.
There
pick.
Was no criminal charge in Eric Garner's death.
Yeah, and you can't pick. You can't pick which cases go viral. That's something like that we've just haven't been able to figure out.
Well, video is definitely an element of the
video is an element.
But
that's
then,
right. Like Ferguson's not going to respond, like Baltimore not going to respond, like Staten Island not going to respond, like South Carolina, like all of these things, they play out in different ways. But yeah, no, video is definitely an element.
Back when I caught my first gun charge, running crazy, we was gone.
So I'm baking cookies the other day, and I did notice that somehow a paper towel that I'd used to wipe up some butter had gotten stuck to the bottom of the baking sheet. I put the cookies in the oven and set the timer for 30 minutes. I figured that gives me enough time to run to the store. So I'm at the store, and I get a notice from the Simply Safe app on my phone. The smoke alarm was going off. I freak out, I rush back home, and I see that somehow the paper towel had caught on fire. It was a small one, but with the butter on it, it smoked out the house. I put it out pretty quickly, but I then thought to myself, what would have happened without my SimpliSafe app? I'm guessing that I would have suffered at least a few $1,000s in damages, my priceless items would have been gone, and perhaps most importantly, I would have had a very angry landlord, possibly a litigious landlord. No bueno. Fortunately, SimpliSafe was there. SimpliSafe's round-the-clock professional security monitoring is just $14.99 a month. At that price, you can't afford not to get SimpliSafe. Get a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week connection to dispatch and lightning-fast response times in emergencies with SimpliSafe Home Security. Order today, and you'll get our special 10% discount. Go now to SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com. That's SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com for a 10% discount off your home security system. That's SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com.
I don't know people who get excited about calling the police when crimes happen to them. Like, unless it's like property damage or theft where you can actually retrieve some money back from your insurance company. If there's no insurance and companies involved, nobody's calling the cops. Communities, they feel more confident policing themselves and just dealing with things the way they would normally deal with things. And that's like a common thing. So, you know, the disconnect is bigger than a disconnect policy wise. It's a real cultural wall that exists there.
Yeah, I got back from California in September and one of my sons had stole my car. The oldest boy stole my car. And I had to report the car stolen and I called the police to my house and they treated me as if I was a criminal. And then attempted to dissuade me from filing a police report.
So they don't got to write a paragraph.
So watch the difference, okay? So let's see, this was what? You said September? So, okay, well, it was probably earlier than September. I live in the city, and I was visiting a friend, and I had ridden my bicycle, and she left the garage door open. And I came out to go home on the bike, and the bike was gone. So I called 311. Which is the non-emergency reporting system, to report that my bicycle was stolen, and said specifically, no need for an officer to come out, okay? Just think you ought to know, you know, it was a larceny, if you're keeping track of larcenies in that area, et cetera. She said, oh, no, we'll call a patrol officer. I said, I don't need a patrol officer. I'm not even there. I had already gone home, you know? Sure enough, a couple of hours later, here come these two patrol officers to my house to take a report on this stolen bicycle. They were very nice. They were very polite. They were very professional. And I said again, you didn't need to come off patrol to do this. So those are two very different experiences. Am I correct?
Very different.
I never felt like I was being accused of anything.
Very different.
And I was telling them that it's not necessary to be here. But they felt compelled that, you know, to come out and take a full report.
It's crazy because it's like they always pop up when you don't need them. But then when somebody's, you know, I live in Waverly. My house has been broken into like 3 times. And it's like, you know, alarm, no alarm, whatever. And it's like, it's a problem when it happens. But then, you know, when it's time to like pull someone over or harass someone or actually do their job, it's like a whole different story. So, yeah, the problem is there. And then again, like you got a person like Jeff Sessions is like, a joke of a person. Like, his whole career is a joke to me. Like, the way he's treated people of color. So it's like, this is what we have to look forward to. And the fact that it's 2017 and a person like that can have this much power in this country is a key indicator that...
Well, it has not just power, but tremendous influence. I mean,
tremendous influence.
I don't know what this federal task force that Trump has set up on the issue of crime. I don't know what's going to come of that. Oh,
God.
And so we have a situation now in Baltimore where we have a signed court order. It's just going to be very interesting to see going forward if the DOJ becomes more and more of an adversarial party. I don't know.
The second I get pulled over, my news story is like, you know, I'm friends with Jay Miller, right? Before you do anything, before you stop me, did you find that bike? Let's start there.
Did you find that bike? That's right.
Did she get that bike back? Let's start there. You could use that too, Kenji. You could use that too.
Here in Baltimore, yeah, I might have to try that. But I think though that even more concerning to me historically is that we have so much violence in our community right now today. I think we are probably at 86 homicides. We just had a murder, I think, up here at Baker in Monroe. That's 86 today. And what bothers me, because we have so many young Black men that are dying, is that because of the damaged relationship between the police department and the Black community, people are reluctant to come forward. And those who would kill us, who look like us, are free to roam our community.
Well,
so, go ahead, I'm listening.
No, well, Kenji, you know, there's obviously a lot more to that, too, which is that these are communities, as you know, you said with Baker and Monroe, that's West Baltimore. These are communities that have had enormous disinvestment and abandonment. And now they're riddled with blight and drug addiction. And, you know, in some communities, your drug treatment center is the only business around. I mean, that's the landscape. So there's been decades of disinvestment and lack of investment in these areas. So trying to get income opportunities, employment opportunities is really
slim. I mean, if we hire so many cops, like, you know, we pay so many police officers, shouldn't they be solving these cases? Like, shouldn't they,
we've got some of those stories lately.
I mean, we pay so many police officers, like, you know.
It's the biggest part of the general fund.
We should be, I mean, I feel like I'm, like, again, you know, maybe there's a little Republican inside of me growing, but I feel like my tax dollars are being wasted because we hire so many police officers that the clearance rate shouldn't be so low.
And actually, that's where I am, because, see, I grew up in those communities, and I live here in Park Heights now, and outside of my door, people are getting high. I'm not sitting out on a push because you would hear them. And so I get that, Jane. I do. I get it. I grew up. I was 20 years old when I graduated from high school. I was the first person in my family to walk across the stage to get a high school diploma and a first person to go off to college. And so I get that. I grew up in a house with no water, lights, or gas. I get that. My mother was an alcoholic. I get it. But at the same time, that still does not justify the level of violence that we have in our community. And so for too long, we made excuses for people who, see, for me, and I love Black people. My grandmother grew up in Mississippi. She was a sharecropper. And so I get that. But I don't like to make excuses for anybody, be they Black or white, for killing Black people. And so for me, it hurts me deeply because I buried my
brother.
I
don't think it's an excuse, though. I think it's a reason. It's a big difference. You know, there's excuses, but then there are reasons. Like, okay, so we can monitor every Black neighborhood in this city, right? But why we can't monitor where these drugs come from? Like, everything, we're constantly, I could walk down a hill, I could walk through Latrobe Housing Project, I could walk up and down Grandma, I could walk all of these different places and be on film. But why can't we get that same type of surveillance from where these drugs come from? Or why I could go inside a white neighborhood that I know, or a white community that I know uses way more drugs than the Black community, and not see the same surveillance?
I'm not going to blame all of the homicides on drugs, though. I don't think we can. I look at people get high every day on my block, and they don't kill each other. I got high, and I didn't kill nobody. I know a whole bunch of people who get high and do not commit homicides. So I don't want to just
label. It's not really the drug. It's capitalism.
Well, and sometimes it's about choice, because what we do when we say, well, when you take drugs to Black neighborhoods and then you take guns to Black neighborhoods, that's what they're going to do. It plays into a racist stereotype that says Black people have no control over their actions.
Well, it's not really about taking drugs and guns into Black neighborhoods. It's about stripping them neighborhoods of opportunity. Just to put it in context, in Baltimore City, 97% of Black people born here in poverty down poverty, and a Black person with some college has less of a chance of getting a job than a white person with some felonies. The social fabric is just destroyed by society. Like, it's not excuses. It's real. Like, I feel you. I don't want to see nobody kill each other either, but I'm not going to sit here and act like that, you know, that we have every opportunity to be able to get out here and do things that aren't really involved with no criminal element.
But you miss what I said. I said folk to say that it's because of guns and drugs in our neighborhoods, we respond that way. Clearly, we understand that we have limited opportunity. We understand the whole concept of structural and institutional racism and the condition it's placed our community, and we're not too far. I mean, I was born in 1969. The year before that, in August of 1968, we got the civil rights legislation. I get that. I totally understand how far behind we are. But then at some point, as a Black man, I have to say we have to take some personal responsibility for our own actions, the way we interact with our brothers and sisters. The level of envy that we have, I mean, maybe this is earning our business, but there is so much jealousy and self-hate and so much intra-racism, which is a product of racism in this country. That so many of us hate ourselves to the point that we would do harm. And those are some things that we have to deal with internally, and we haven't. And I will totally agree, that is a byproduct of racism. But we have to overcome that, because it's becoming too deadly, not just here in Baltimore, but in St. Louis, in Chicago, Detroit, Memphis, New Orleans, wherever you go, where we are, we have to stop hating each other.
It's not a back and forth thing. All I'm saying is that it's the difference between an excuse and a reason. And I don't think, like, I'm not going to sit here and blindly say that, like, nobody's taking personal responsibility. Like, I think that's, like, I think it would be general to assume that nobody's out here trying to, like, work or resist against that.
Yeah, Kinji, I agree too. I think the issue of violence and what you're talking about self-hatred, all of it, it's a very complicated reality. And we have dealt with one single thing in poor communities for 30 years, and that's policing. That's what we've done. The investment that has gone into poor communities in this country has been for law enforcement. There's been some for housing, but there's been very little investment in economic opportunity in the communities that are so challenged. So what's the difference between why is crime concentrated in areas that have no opportunity, that are unstable, that are destabilized, that have a lot of blight? Why is that? There's not a lot of hope that goes on and a lot of anything positive that goes on in those communities. And every day that passes is another day that you look around and you've been left behind, right?
I agree with Kenji saying to a certain extent, but it also, like, even just that whole idea, I guess what I'm trying to say is the whole idea of the victim blaming kind of ties into the same idea of where the problem stemmed from. The only problem with Black people in this country is that Black people think there's something wrong with Black people, and that's it. That's the only problem. So even to sit here and say that it's our fault for our conditions, it ties into the same thing that we're fighting against without acknowledging the bigger forces in place.
No, I don't think nobody has said that. And I know I didn't say that. You know, I'm looking at the fact that I'm, you know, as a minister over 30 years, when you go to the cemetery as much as I have and stand at the head of 14-year-old kids and say, now it's for as much and it has pleased Almighty God to take out of this world of a little boy, that stuff starts to get to you. Clearly, I think I've said it, Jane, and maybe you can attest to it. I've said it for years. When we talk about blight in Baltimore, I said it is a conditioning. When we look at Park Heights and throughout this city, and we raise children up in neighborhoods where they see nothing but blight, it has an impact on them. I've said that. I've said it time and time again. I think I've been one of the few activists in this city who have pushed the whole idea that we need to do something with these vacant properties. And because our children live in these neighborhoods and walk by fields and fields of weeds every day. So I get that. I get the whole concept. I'm not going to limit it to just that and not say the brothers, because it's not all of them, because if it was all of us, we would all be dead. But to those who are committing these acts of violence, they have to be responsible for their own acts. And they don't represent me, because I'm not a generalist. And I don't say, you know, that because I'm Black, we all act alike. Hell no, we don't do that. But to those who are in our community, that are terrorizing our community, robbing children of their fathers, robbing mothers of their sons, I have a big issue.
So how do we get to
like
the root
that.
Of the problem? How do we get to the root of the problem? How do we stop that?
One thing we have to do is, first of all, we have to start investing in our neighborhoods. We get that. But we also have to start investing in our families.
Yes, but what do you mean when you say invest in our neighborhoods? And who is we? Like us as the people or the people that constantly strip and extract from our neighborhoods?
Well, the people who strip and extract, of course, we understand and we see development that goes on in Baltimore. And it is exclusive of Sandtowns and Park Heights. It's exclusive of those neighborhoods unless it borders places like Hopkins and the University of Maryland. Unless it borders those places, those our communities continuously are neglected. I get that. But there's a holistic issue here I think that we have to address, because I'm not going to just deal with white folk racism, because I know it exists. You know, my grandmother told me something when I was getting ready to go off to college. I said, "Grandmother, what's some advice you want to give your grandson going off?" And the first thing she told me was, "Don't trust white folk." And I'm taking that to heart, you know, because I personally have had a hard time, almost 50, trusting white people. Because my experience growing up in a black city, East St. Louis was much blacker than Baltimore. 99% of the people lived in the city I grew up with were black. And so when we went outside of that city, we encountered racism. So I get the racist aspect of it. And I get the fact that so many people and institutions have extrapolated from our community. They extrapolated us from an entire continent and brought us here and enslaved us.
That's why I'm asking, when you say invest, I'm saying, where are we getting the money from? Like, who's supposed to invest in the community? I was one of the people who bought some of them houses on Durham Street when I thought I was going to get a check when Hopkins was coming through buying people. Wow, that ain't work. That ain't work.
If you look at it like that, because it's much greater than what they're giving me for a piece of property, there has to be a total investment in education, housing, and jobs, and we get that. And so what has happened too often is that we think they're small. And I'm not saying that you're doing that, because I don't believe that type of problem. But the realism is there has to be some real serious investment in our community. We get that. I think most of us who are connected in those ways understand we have to have that investment.
No, I agree with you 100%. That's why I live in East Baltimore. That's why I didn't live in East Baltimore, because young people in Baltimore City, they need to see a journalist and a college professor and an author in their neighborhood. That adds to their own concept of theory into what they can be. Like, I get all that, but when I'm talking about these people who suffer this trauma and who go through this pain and who commit these things, and I'm with you. I don't want to see nobody get killed, but I'm saying, like, how do we get to the root of the issue that's causing it? Because it's not us. We're not born with that type of hate. We just have to face a society that dumps that type of hate on us.
Well, when you live in a community in Baltimore City some years ago, we had 7,500 children that was in foster care. That was children who was removed from their families and placed into a foster care system. And me and Dan Rogers had the conversation. He thought, well, maybe because we don't have those many kids in foster care anymore, everything was okay. But the realism is those kids aged out of foster care with nowhere to go and with no... My boys are adopted. I took 5 kids out of foster care. And so until we understand that we have a lot of children coming from broken homes and broken situations, and we talk about real investment, the bottom line is the best investment you can do in the life of a young person, and I push this too, is that we become mentors and families to broken children. And sometimes when you mentor a broken child, you got to deal with all the broken mess he does. And there's too many young people in our city that are detached from families. And even in the families that they are, many of our kids grow up never feeling love or in families that are being abused and hurt. Because guess what? They come from mothers and fathers who grew up just like them because of the same social conditions you mentioned earlier.
This is hard. It's real. It's Kenji, I mentor a young man, too, that was in foster care and is now an adult. And it's, again, it's hard for people to understand. People who have grown up and lived their lives with somewhat of a support system around them, so that when, you know, the car breaks down, they've got somebody to take them to work. When the child is sick, they've got somebody to pick them up at school. There are many, many people, as Kenji has talked about, they don't have any of that. They are on their own. And I was just talking to a city school teacher yesterday. We were having this conversation about, you know, the kind of the key to the kingdom of this, of trying to get to a better place, is for something to take the place. So this was in the context of the conversations about which of the schools that are most successful. Well, the schools that are most successful have the most parental involvement. Well, that makes sense, right? You've got all these people that are invested in the school succeeding. So when you don't have parental involvement in a school, for a lot of reasons, you have chaotic households, you've got parents working, you know, single parents working three jobs. There are lots of reasons that you may not have a parent invested in that particular school. What is the structure that takes the place of that kind of investment in the success of the school and in the success of the child? If it's not the parent, what is it? And I am not saying, oh, yank the kid out and put in kid in foster care. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying as a society to recognize that there are many, just countless children that are growing up on their own.
I'm from the Andy Jones era, when homicides was high. Every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West side be getting money, but it's different on my side.
I'm on the road a lot, like three times a month a lot. Like, I just got back from Helsinki, Finland, and now I'm going to Portland, Oregon a lot. So I understand the ins and outs of business travel, and I'm always looking for ways to make it easier, more affordable, and a little more rewarding. That's why I want to tell you about Upside.com, the best new way to buy business travel for you, your team, or your whole business. With Upside.com, you don't have to search endlessly for all the flights, then the hotel. Upside.com bundles it all for you and offers you one low price for your business travel. If that wasn't good enough, you are still eligible for all your loyalty points and programs. And here's a kicker. When you go to Upside.com and book your first trip, enter promo code BIZTRIP and you're guaranteed to receive a minimum $200 Amazon gift card. So that's low price for business travel, big rewards, and a better business trip. You can't beat that. Log on to Upside.com for more information. Minimum purchase required. See site for complete details. Safe travels, everyone.
So my experience is a little different because I'm a little younger than Kenji. I was born in the 80s and I had to grow up in the crack era and all that. And I can only speak from my own experience. I don't try to like speak from a different person's perspective that I haven't lived. So from my experience, it's just that, you know, I just feel like, especially coming from my neighborhood, the social and the economic capital to combat this system full of all of this bigotry is just not there. It's not there. So, yeah, black on black crime kills me. Any type of crime kill. I don't want to say, like, I lost my brother. I lost any and everyone who had, like, the biggest influence on my young adult life growing up is dead. I already know. But I feel like we have to get to a place to acknowledge, like, the root of these issues. If we're not digging out the roots, then they're going to continue to exist.
And I agree. I think we should be able to do all of them together, and we can't just be one-sided. And when it comes to crime, we got to deal with people who are committing violent crimes at the same time. Get to the roots of it. We know, because the realism is, if we don't, those kids that we're trying to get to the roots of it to save, they're going to still die in the street. And our job also should be making sure we preserve life too. And so I guess, you know, yeah, I think we should be able to do both of them at the same time.
You get somebody silly like Martin O'Malley who, you know, says, I'm going to fix this problem and invest in cities, and he just lock everybody up. You know, then you got cameras everywhere, but then you got like the big time pastors, the Rolls Royce pastors, you know, co-signing that. Oh yeah, O'Malley, be tough on crime. You know, this sounds great. And these are also a group of people who, they're not like you. You have connection to people. You connected to the people. They're not connected to the people. They sit on the top of the throne and they have the money to be able to pull these strings, and then all of us have to suffer. So it's creating the culture all over again, and it's just a cycle.
But that's why church membership has fallen off. Historically, the black church used to be the center of the black community. And that started to fall off in the 80s. I remember, you know, people stopped going because you could no longer go to the church. It would have been impossible for what happened to Freddie Gray and all of these other men in this city, and for the blight in the community that exists in our community right now, 50 years ago, for black preachers not to stand up and say, wait a minute, foul, we can't have that. Nowadays, they profit off of the blight that's in our community.
Oh my God. So I'm a reporter. I'm a journalist, right? I get paid for like little TV appearance. I get little hit fees, right? All of the preachers that was there was like, yo, what's your hit fee? What's the hit fee? And I'm not saying they're not supposed to get paid. Like, I'm not saying that. But like, I felt like a lot of them was popping up for that little fee. And I'm asking you, why you think it fell off in the 80s? Where did that come from?
Well, that's a hard question, because I think it became more about money. You know, I think people got comfortable with the whole, you know, here it is right here. The post-civil rights movement did it. You know, prior to that, Black people had to rely on each other. We had our own businesses in our community. We had our own stores. The majority of us went to HBCUs. Look at HBC membership right now. It's down. It's in a gutter. And so I think the post-civil rights movement during the 70s, where people felt empowered because now Black people were making middle income earnings, working at the factories like Ford and General Motors. And so people were making money and they were going to church, but then they started finding themselves in other ways and detaching the church. But the churches, the preachers were profiting from these middle income earners. And it became about the money and not about the community. And that's what we see today. It became more about the community. The whole concept of white folk water is colder than ours, or that their ice is colder. We believe that. Look what happened to our communities. White folk moved out in terms of white flight. And so we stayed in the communities, but those who were able to move out to places like Reisterstown, they left. They left the neighborhoods. And when they left the neighborhoods, the community started to fall apart. And that just didn't happen here in Baltimore. It happened all across the nation. We followed them, and the further we followed them, the more they moved away from us and the more we moved away from our communities. And guess what? When they moved away, the pastors moved away. The average pastor in Baltimore City do not live in Baltimore. They live in the county.
They just come here to think they come to the city to pick money up and then go back home.
Exactly. But there's no real investment. Come on, man. You go through a church. You go through any community on Sunday morning, it's full of cars. Go through that Monday through Friday. What you see? You see this big old church, but you don't see that church involved in the community. You know, you don't see them involved in the community. They even charge people to have funerals at their church. Come on. The saddest thing in the world when you have a preacher standing over a body who you paying $150 to preach the funeral of somebody who's been murdered.
Trust me, I paid for like four of them in the last 2 years. I already know.
So even when we looked at Freddie Gray, and we go back to Freddie Gray, I mean, come on. You had people like me and Heber Brown and C.D. Witherspoon who are going to always be there for the community as preachers, as young preachers. They're younger than me. But we're going to always be on the forefront of the fight because our heart is where we live at. And unfortunately, we don't have that from our Black church anymore. There should be absolutely no way that our churches should not be standing up, speaking out right now. Very few pastor preachers of major churches in this city came forward to even have a conversation about the consent decree. They didn't. When I hear the mayor talking about she's talking to the pastors, I scratch my head and ask, which ones is she talking to? Because she definitely can't be talking to the major ones. They have neglected the community. And we just said, I mean,
not the ones with them Visa credit card strip belt buckles.
And can I just add a note to all of this too? I mean, the city's population has continued to drop. And I just think we ought to all keep in mind that I think it's flat out wrong to expect people to continue to live in these communities that are so abandoned. And so there's an upside to movement, to mobility. And that is that, you know, the suburban areas have become more diverse and there are people move because they want better housing, they want better opportunity, they want better schools for their kids. And I'm not going to blame anybody for that.
Right.
And that is happening.
That's where it becomes tough at. Like, if you have children and you know what's going on in the school system and you want, like, a better school for your kids, are you going to fight to build that school or are you going to put your child
in some cases, it's happening.
I can say I live in a city. I'm not moving from the city. Right. I don't have children, and I've been traveling for the last 2 years, like, half the year. So, like, you know, I can't make the same argument. If I had kids, you know, I don't know. I feel like I would put them in a public school, but I don't have them, so I can't say it.
Well, I just think that the going forward, that the smart thing to do in a city like Baltimore, Detroit, Cleveland, is to think, what do we want to be? And do we want to continue to try to rebuild an abandoned community? Or do you want to try to invest in communities that have the best chance of providing good opportunity, good schools, and good stability, and to really focus on how do you get that done? In other words, pick your fights.
Amelia, is there anything from our listeners that you wanted to speak on? Or
I guess I would say, I think that one of the things that's been interesting to see about the feedback from people to the podcast, it kind of depends on which platform we're looking at, but like on Twitter, I see a lot of people spawning really positively. And like, you know, a lot of, I think, white listeners sort of having their minds opened to how different their own experience is in terms of not just the police, but just sort of like poverty issues and resource issues. And like, I'm excited to see what listeners think of this addendum after listening. Like, I'm just been sitting here listening to you guys because I feel like I'm learning so much and having my sort of perspective opened. I mean, I don't live in Baltimore, so whenever I hear people who live in Baltimore sort of talking extensively about what it's like, I just sort of like love to listen and have my understanding of the city broadened and better understood. Because Baltimore to me is, I love Baltimore. I think Baltimore is an amazing, interesting city. And at the same time, I also recognize that it has so many problems. And I guess, like, I don't even know if this is like the kind of question to ask, but I sort of wonder, like, what can white citizens in Baltimore, like, how can they, you know, what can be done in terms of sort of supporting the lower income communities, Black communities, and helping, I guess. Is there anything like,
yeah, I can tell you.
Of,
I can answer that question.
Go support Black business.
Yes, that's correct. But there's also, you know, talk to your friends, your neighbors, your family members. I interviewed a woman on Thursday who testified, white woman, lives in, I want to say she lives in Waverly. She testified, she read the DOJ report and said, quote, "I was embarrassed that I didn't know how bad it was." And that's a powerful statement. So, yeah, if you're somebody that doesn't have those experiences and those exposures, but you're familiar with them, it's about talking to people, people that you know, to say, no, the city school system isn't a disaster. No, it's not that like that. And to encourage people to, as Kinji said, to mentor young people and to really get involved. I think there's lots and lots and lots of roles for people if we really want to start to improve the lives of the Freddie Grays of the world.
Yeah, I'm all about bottom up. Like, I don't think anything's ever going to trickle down from anywhere.
I agree with you.
Any form of government. Like Kenji said, it's all about what we're going to do for us. I guess our disagreement kind of came from the whole accountability issue, which is positive because we need that. You know, we got to flush these ideas out. Kenji, did you want to close us out with anything?
My concern is, and what truly grieves me is this murder and this violence in this city. My heart is broken, and we have to save some lives. We really do. And we have to have a mayor and a state's attorney that takes this real serious. And I'm really just not feeling that. This has not been taken serious enough. We're losing way too many young men in this city. We've had 10 shootings, 11 actually since Saturday, with the one we just had today. And that's heartbreaking to know this. So, and I've been to so many of these funerals. And a notion that our fathers, and I want to say this too, the notion that Black fathers are absent, we need to stop saying it, because there's so many men that I've held in the last year who lost their sons, that we need to keep them lifted in our prayers for real. And we have to start really investing in our young men and becoming an active player in our young women, too. Becoming active players in their lives. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Thank you. Amelia?
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you guys for coming on the show. And for, you know, I guess one thing I would want to say to listeners is, I can say this is like, you know, I feel like in terms of speaking to white people about these kinds of issues, I feel like this project has been incredibly illuminating for me as a person who was already kind of came into it with my own sort of liberal views and all of that kind of stuff. But simply listening to people who have different experiences than you instead of being defensive it's beneficial for your own life. And so I feel like for those listeners who at times feel sort of defensive of, you know, cops and perhaps white people, well, you know, I don't know. Put it aside and do yourself a favor and also do the person who is speaking a favor and just listen. Because, you know, I really think that it can only benefit your outlook on the world. So that's
great.
That.
Great. And Jane?
Oh, I would agree. I think that if you want to talk about the Freddie Gray case in particular, it encompasses so many of the challenges that we've just talked about for the past hour and some. From poverty to lack of opportunity to bad relationships between the way we police in communities, all of that is encompassed in this case. And it's very easy for people who don't live in these communities, who don't have to deal with poor people and who don't have bad relationships with police, to just write it off mm-hmm. and not pay attention to it. And then not only that, but then, you know, slam everybody who wants to say, hey, you know, we need to do better. And I absolutely agree about the work that you have to do as an individual to open your eyes and open your mind and understand the other side.
Yeah. And that's like so much of the reason why we wanted to do this podcast. You know, I think there was an element of it absolutely that was about trying to find out, kind of fill in all the sort of blanks as in terms of what happened to Freddie that day. But it was about so much more, and that this was a story about like a city and a community and about a human being and a person with friends and family who lived a 25 years on this planet, whose story deserved to be heard, whether or not it was we found out exactly, you know, what was the fatal injury caused by and all of that. That's part of it, but it's hardly the whole thing.
And people, like most people, don't know even where Freddie Sr. was a graduate. He was my fraternity. His mm-hmm. dad is my fraternity. I'm a member of Phi Beta Sigma. His Aww. Dad is a Sigma, graduated from Morgan State University. And the Sigma showed up that day of the visitation. And most people don't talk about that because mm-hmm. we think that he came from an uneducated family, and it wasn't the case.
No, I'm glad you added that. And I want to thank you guys. Thank you guys for coming on. You guys were great. Where can we keep up with you guys at, starting with Amelia?
I am on Twitter under @XOAmelia. If you have any case questions, notice weird things in the CCTV footage that you want to alert me to that maybe I haven't seen, I probably have, but try me, you can tweet at me there.
And Apostle Kenji Scott, where can we find you at?
On Twitter and on Facebook. Apostle Kenji Scott on Twitter and Kenji Scott on Facebook.
Okay. And Jane?
I'm on Twitter at J.E. Miller, WBAL. And then I'm also on Facebook. If you do Jane Miller, WBAL, you'll find me. I have one of those fan pages, which is a little different than those other pages. You can't really do anything with them.
Jane with a Y, though.
Jane with a Y. That's correct. Jane with a Y. Definitely it gives away my age because my mother named it that way. So
really? I think absolutely. I think it's so cool. I didn't realize that was a...
Correct. That was a thing. That's correct.
I'm at D-Watkins World on all social media. Thank you guys so much, and please have a blessed day. Reminder to fans to participate in social media discussion. You can discuss the episode with the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda with the hashtag UD addendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle UndisclosedPOD.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks to Ryan and Ernesto for continuing to support us. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum, along with super producer Meethal Telhan. A big thanks to three great sponsors for this week's addendum. They include Hunt a Killer, Simply Safe, and Upside. You know, the last time I talked about Hunt a Killer, I was asked if I was saying Hunt a Killer or Hunt a Killer. Please forgive the Baltimore accent. I will enunciate here. It's Hunt a Killer. Great product, great sponsor. Go check them out. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music. Don't forget, Patrick is up for a Webby. Go to www.vote.webbyawards.com and search for Undisclosed to vote for Patrick's theme song. The embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist who lends his sound to our show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Undisclosed Pod. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 8. Until then.